The next speaker is Dirk van der Meyle from Geneva. While he gets set up, I just wanted to announce that at the end of these three talks and before the discussion session, we're going to have a short presentation by Steve Kivelson, who very kindly accepted to talk to us about the CARE effect, which admittedly is an aspect which is missing in this conference up to this point. So we'll give a brief presentation about this, and then we'll have the discussion. Okay, Dirk.
Okay, thank you very much, Antoine and Louis, for the invitation to a fantastic instructive meeting. So when I saw the list of questions that Antoine sent around, I hadn't fully made up my mind what to speak about, but then I made up my mind to say a few things about what the indications are, partly from our own work, but also from the literature, for the pseudo gap in the frequency and temperature dependence of the optical conductivity. Am I audible this way? This way I am, yes, yes. This is work, well, I talk about a lot of work, but I mean, an important part of the work was actually done in collaboration with my PhD students, Mirzai and Stricker, and postdocs on Hancock, with Dr. Berthaud in Geneva, and Antoine, and various other people, especially Martin Graven and Barisic and their collaborators who provided samples, and Eric van Heumen for a lot of discussions and so on. Now it doesn't work anymore. Ah. So the optical conductivity of the C-axis oriented by BCO, this is a very famous result that many of you, of course, know. This is where the pseudo gap was seen in the first place. In using optical techniques, and they use the C-axis because there is some chemical reason why, if you measure along the C-axis in the cuprates, you pick out regions of the Fermi surface. Regions of the Fermi surface, which are close to the antinodal points. And so, cooling down, you very clearly see that there is a very nice gap opening here when you go down in temperature. And this is the gap. Okay, there are a couple of phonons here, and after you subtract out the phonons, it's even easier to follow. I'm not going to talk about this peak, but it's really interesting. Here are optical data. These are our own optical data, and also show together with the data from Christoph Renner. It's indeed true, after Andy's talk, I checked the slide. It was already in my slides, actually. I checked myself. If you go from the normal state where you already have the pseudo gap and you cool down in the superconducting state, in the STM, this gap is getting a little bit smaller than the pseudo gap. This is the optical conductivity of an underdoped mercury 1201, TC of 67 Kelvin.
This is not
C-axis. This is not C-axis, this is AB plane. You go, in fact, the temperatures are covered by this graph. The highest one is 390 Kelvin, which is this red curve. Cool down to room temperature, then you're around here-ish. And then you go farther down, this here, the gray curves are already in the superconducting state. This is 60 and 100 Kelvin, this is just above. Clearly, you do have a pseudo-gap-like feature in the optics, even in the AB plane, for those underdoped samples. Optimally doped is much more difficult to see. And the temperature where you can no longer say that you see anything is around, well, 250 or 200, a bit more than 200 Kelvin. In this case, cooling down into the superconducting state does not shift this peak down, so it depends on the spectroscopy. I did check during the break on other optical data, but you don't see the shift. Now, if you do optical conductivity, you can also take the optical conductivity extrapolated to zero frequency. There's a way doing this called the Hagen-Rubens extrapolation. And that gives the green dots of the same data I showed before, but now binned in 5 Kelvin intervals. In principle, all those data we take at 1 Kelvin intervals. But binning in 5 Kelvin gives a bit, little bit better signal to noise. That's the green dots, and the red line, that's the DC resistance you get by just putting wires on your sample. And so here, you see a change of behavior at this point, which is traditionally indicated as where the pseudo gap starts. This is T star. You can actually see what the challenge is to find back a T star in an optical experiment. It requires optical data with this kind of precision, not only with this kind of vertical precision, but also with this kind of horizontal density in temperatures before you can actually make statements about T star. You really need to measure many temperatures, as you do with any other technique, otherwise it becomes hard to tell. You know, it may be a good idea if I put my computer here, because then I can stay closer to the microphone. It's what the Germans call Seilsalat. Okay, so if you look at the optical response of a classical charged liquid, this is actually true for, it doesn't even require any quantum mechanics, then you get a Drude peak centered at zero frequency. If you take the real part of this optical conductivity, there's a numerator which is given by the optical infrared spectral wave, density times charge squared over mass. And you have this inverse relaxation time in the denominator that gives the width. The generalization to interacting electrons in the cuprates is sometimes convenient to write the conductance in terms of the sheet conductance, that one divided by the elementary conductance, that's the inverse Klitzing here, is a similar kind of expression. Now appears here a thing we call k, pi times k. It's just a constant which is proportional to the spectral weight, about which we will not speak. But in the denominator, you have tau minus 1 minus I omega, times m star, where tau can now be frequency dependent, but if this is frequency dependent, that should also be frequency dependent to stay Kramers-Kronig consistent. And this k, as I said, you can actually obtain by just integrating your optical spectrum. That's the way to get that number very precisely. It's just the integrated spectral. It's essentially the pole strength of what you have here. We often use a slightly different notation here. We call what we had before the memory function, and from that we subtract I omega. If this is zero, we have just the delta function peak, and if it's broadened, 1 over tau becomes this M2, and this gives you a mass minimization term. Okay, so this can be then straightforwardly inverted. Once you have this k, you take the inverse of the formula, you multiply with your k that you got from integrating the optical spectral weight, and it gives you the M2, which is 1 over tau, that is your relaxation rate. And this is what that looks like. It has, as I said, you have the relaxation rate shown over here, and then there's the real part of the self-energy, which has to do with the slope of it. It actually gives you the mass minimization factor. And you see, for a few more temperatures than before now, that this relaxation rate starting at 390 Kelvin and going down is digging a hole in here, and they go into the superconducting state and it digs up a hole a bit more. Of course, we'll take a closer look at this curvature over here, but already it's important to see that in this curve and in that curve, there is a feature here which has everything to do with the pseudo gap that I pointed out before. So it's because it is the same feature, but just reflected in a different way of plotting the experimental data. This here is again the resistivity. Just to show to you that if you fit, you put a T-square curve on top of the experimental resistivity, it fits extremely well up to about 200 Kelvin. Another way of looking at it is taking the resistance derivative, shown here between 0 and 400 Kelvin. It has a maximum over there, but here it's a straight line, and that actually means that you have a T-square temperature dependence with noise, of course, because you take a derivative. Also note that there is it's very hard in this curve, like it is in that curve, actually to identify a very precise T-star, which is actually where this is supposed to become linear. You know, in this curve, where it would have to start to go constant. It's a very smooth affair, really. Now, this square behavior of the inverse lifetime that it motivates to look at, take a look at the single particle lifetime expression from the classical literature says, this is correct, yeah. The lifetime itself would be 1 over energy square, but then there's a temperature correction on it, and that's related to the energy square by just adding to that pi square plus kBT square. If you take the optical relaxation rate, the inverse of this, but now for the optics, it would be my M2 that I mentioned before. That should be, according to the same theory, given by a constant times omega square, h bar omega square, plus 2 pi kbt square. I substituted for 2 a p over here because we are going to consider that as an experimental parameter that we also have to fit experimentally. But for optics, this is supposed to be 2. That was first described by Gursky, then many details by Maslov and Chubukov, and also in many details and with different kind of versions by Bertot and collaborators, including Antoine and myself. And so what you can do then, again, this is the imaginary part of this M2. This is 1 over tau that I spoke about. But now plotted as a function of energy squared, then of course it should, if it's true what I said, it should start out being linear and then saturate maybe, well, actually you don't know what it should do, but it seems to saturate at a certain point. And in fact, if you now plot it not only as a function of omega squared, but omega squared plus p pi kbt squared, where p is to be decided, in fact, then all these curves should actually collapse on a single graph, and they do. Only they don't do it for p equals 2 as it should, but they do it for, in this case, for p equals 1.5. We have one other example more recent on strontium-ruthenate where it actually works with p equals 2, but for the cuprates it has to be 1.5. So there's something quite Fermi liquid-like about this. Fermi liquid-ish. Quite Fermi liquid-like. Fermi liquid-like, not Fermi liquid.
Excuse me, Dirk, is it a problem that it doesn't go smoothly into 0?
Here?
Yeah.
Well, I assume it is an experimental problem, because in fact these things come from measuring reflectivity, and you have to calibrate it. And these calibrations are hairy. You do it by evaporating gold on a sample, and so this is probably a small offset we have there. So if you now plot it as a function of xi, which is this number here, but then the square root of it, you find back this sort of t or energy square behavior, but you see very clearly that there is a point where it no longer follows that curve. And again, that is what earlier on we called the pseudo gap in the optical conductivity spectrum. There are two more examples where we did the same analysis. This one we already talked about. This is yttrium 123, which was reported in literature for the same doping, 0.1, and bismuth 2-01 also for the same doping. In all these cases, you get a nice collapse of your inverse scattering time, your relaxation rate, and always on the same slope, and it always requires p equals 1.5. Okay, then here's a graph which you will not find in the literature. We should publish it someday, where we did the same analysis for many more crystals in different dopings. And the first thing is to notice that this p is 1.5, 1.5, 1.4, 1.6, 1.5, 1.7. So roughly 1.5 in all cases. Precision is not that high of this number. The other thing is you can do is just, okay, look at up to which point this actually follows this energy square law and where does it become what looks like an energy linear behavior, which is the case for all of them. Okay, it's a bit of a rough job, but essentially this scale is plotted over here and it's pretty much independent of which sample you take. The other thing you can do is fit this behavior to a background value plus A1 xi plus A2 xi square, and the A2 term, so the energy square term in the relaxation, so the Fermi liquid-like term, is biggest here and smallest there. It's the wrong curve. It's biggest here and smallest there, and the linear term over here goes up, goes through a maximum, and then down again, so that seems to more correlate, actually, with the highest TC in this compound. This is a point that also has been pointed out by Hussey based on the resistivity data. Now, another way to look at these data is to use strong coupling theory. This is a whole machinery that was invented essentially by Philip Allen, where he said, okay, this memory function can be expressed in terms of the single particle self energies. The single particle self energies can be expressed in terms of our glue function, alpha square f, for those who think in terms of phonons, or I square chi, if you think more in terms of spin susceptibilities. These are Bose factors and fermion factors, so this is a universal function, and this gives you the self energy, and that in the end, so after 1 to 3 integrations, gives you the memory function. This you can fit to your experimental data, and that's what we have done many years ago, and we're still doing this kind of exercise. You try to fit a parameterization of your pi. Typically we take some kind of a histogram for that, and we fit that to the experimental data using through these formulas. And we do it with just some honest to God, you close your eyes and let the least square fitting routine decide about the blocks. Always gives you something like this. Here we see two of those real parts of the memory functions fitted with the same function. So the temperature dependencies that you see here are all generated by this universal part of the previous expression. And it's this block structure, which is our glue function. It has a peak over here, which is very similar to the one that, well, serves the same position, I guess, where Andrew showed it this morning, and there is more stuff higher up. The precise shape of this varies a bit from one attempt fitting it to another, because it's pretty daunting fitting through all these integrations. But still, you always find back this robust peak in that. We for a long time thought this could be a phonon, so I was very happy when I saw Andrew's results 2 years back, I think, where clearly it's not a phonon because there's no phonon in his calculation. And so it could, after all, be electronic. The question is, what is it? Now, but any case, important here is, again, the pseudo-gap feature, which is really the shoulder here, is in this formalism generated by this peak. Of course, it's Heenan interpreter. We have data and we fit something to it. You don't have necessarily to believe it, but it's sort of interesting to see that it also follows from the Herbert model and the MFT. Now, a few more. How are we doing with time?
You have 5 more minutes.
Great.
10
even, yeah? Yeah. So these are examples of different dopings of the single layer bismuth 2-0-1, where you just see the optical connectivity. This is a very underdoped one where you see some optical phonons. There's a bit of funny structure over here. Who knows, maybe that is already the spin density or charge density wave gap. At the time we saw that, we certainly were not thinking along those lines. Thought more had to do with disorder. But then you go to higher doping and quickly you start to see a Drudish-like peak. And again, on these different dopings, we can unleash our fitting with this Allen model. And if you do that, for the lowest doped one, we get just a very big peak over here that actually translates into those real parts of memory functions. Again, it's this maximum here that normally we would call the pseudo-gap feature. And then for higher and higher dopings, you see that this peak is shrinking, and you're actually, for higher doping, getting more of this high-frequency stuff. But this peak is sort of disappearing, and so this reflects that the pseudo-gap feature is essentially disappearing and is being replaced by something else, which is much smoother, but not Drude-like. It's still electrons coupled to something, or maybe one shouldn't use those terms. These are even more different samples. So from left to right is from underdoped to overdoped in these two series of samples, and these are optimally doped ones. The trends are very clear if you compare all this. It's always has a long tail on the high frequency side. In all cases, there is a peak, but this peak is getting small on the overdoped side and is big on the underdoped side. And it's almost at the same energy. You can, if you want to push it a bit farther, and well, why? Maybe one shouldn't, but we did. We say, okay, let's just believe that all this stuff is our glue that actually pairs electrons, and we just calculate TC using the Ely-Yarsberg theory with that. It's just a gross simplification because we didn't really try to make do a composition in different K spaces, but if we would have done a K-space decomposition, we would have put in arbitrary parameters anyways that we don't know about experimentally. So we try to do it in a way that you can at least repeat it. You can take our glue function, feed it in the same formula, and you would actually find these values of TCs, which are obviously too high. They're even too high if you compare them not to the experimental TCs, but experimental TCs of bismuth 2-1-2 after correcting for fluctuations, as it was done by Dave Talon. But even then it is too high, but at least it's not too small. And so it does give you a bit of a dome shape, and I would say it puts you in the right ballpark and on the right side of the fence, not on the too small side of the fence. There are always things that are going to make it smaller. However, if you use this same philosophy, and now you're going to look at the resistivity, and now we come back to the pseudo-gap and the T-star story, the simplest model, which is Fermi liquid model actually, for the T square behavior, would not be to take those blocks, but to take a glue function, which is just a linear function of frequency, which actually continues all the way up. Now, in order to mimic the fact that we have in the experimental M2, this shoulder over there, or the peak in the M1, we actually let it just stop somewhere and then go down. And this would be normally, if it were a Fermi liquid, and this were all Fermi liquid, you would call your effective Fermi temperature. If you do that, this model predicts the blue dots. This is what the resistivity should do as a function of temperature. So it starts out T square and then crosses over very gradually to T linear. In the experimental data, there where it crosses over to T linear, actually in the experimental data, it starts to dip below the straight line. So this is where we are no longer on the T square, and actually it goes deeper than the straight line. So there is a discrepancy with the very simple glue model, or actually very simple Fermi liquid model that we used. And that happens right where it's no longer Fermi liquid-like. But it doesn't seem to describe, so what we're doing here can't describe what you actually see over here. And then in order to make it work, this would have to go negative or something like that. So it's actually not possible in a model to represent this downturn, except if you would make this function temperature dependent. Of course, we have tried that too, but then you're putting really a lot of parameters in the model, and then it's no longer a simple model anymore. So that's not so elegant. So actually, one might say that we actually have an indication here from comparing to theory that indeed this resistance that comes down and then starts to drop more has a change over here in behavior to something we sort of understand, to something that is not described by this model anymore. In fact, this is well known, of course, for a long time. This is not the oldest. The oldest goes back to 1992, 1993, I think. Papers on YBCO, double layer and triple layer. This is this linear part of the resistance, and then it starts coming down. It's only a recent development that we start to look at this behavior as intrinsically T squared. Okay. Well, okay. So there are many graphs here, too many. But why do we show it? This is again back to the C-axis. And what these people did, this is the Max Planck group, they measured the optical conductivity along the C-axis in the mid-infrared range as a function of temperature, and really with relatively dense sampling. This actually shows you how the pseudo-gap seen in the C-axis evolves as a function of temperature. It's a very gradual thing also, but at least you can see a maximum over here. This is the same kind of analysis done by the group of Tajima in Japan. It's not exactly the same parameter, but also obtained on YBCO, different dopings along the C direction. And again, there is this maximum over here. They actually did an analysis also, assuming there could be pair formation. In fact, both groups did. This is the T star that these people got, and that's the T star that Max Planck got. The scales have been adjusted so that this scale fits on that scale and this scale fits on that scale. So the fact that the slopes are different here is significant. Both teams call T star, both on C-axis data of YBCO. So in fact, if you just try to put it together, this is actually the slice in which apparently T star varies according to how you look at the data. There's actually a factor of 2.5 difference if you stay at the same temperature between here and there. 2.5. Yeah, so it's the difference between 100 and 250 Kelvin. No, this is not nothing. So this is really illustrating the difficulty one has if there is not really a thermodynamical phase transition visible in the data. I have to be careful about what I say because in order data people see that. Now, just for a last point, Nicole Bontin and collaborators have looked at this a long time ago, and they said, okay, in the in-plane infrared spectral weight of the pseudo-gap, in the pseudo-gap regime, actually the in-plane spectral weight given by the red points here, if you integrate over all frequencies up to 20,000, it doesn't depend much on temperature anymore, and there's no sudden change at T star. This is T star of this particular sample. This is an overdoped one, and T star is no longer there. But here, there's nothing happening at this particular T star for any, actually, of the cuts they take in temperature. Of course, at TC, things happen, but not at T star. Now, if to go back to our data on Mercury 1201, maybe there is something, but it's really very subtle. If you look at the M star as a function of temperature, measured at different frequencies, then we see something. So this is for 20 milli-electron volt, it goes through a maximum over here. And for 10 milli-electron volt, it goes through a maximum for all of them. If you plot these maxima as a function of temperature, then for frequency extrapolating to zero, it extrapolates to around 200, a bit more than 200 Kelvin. So that would be a way of defining a crossover temperature, where you cross over from a regime where the mass decreases as you go up in temperature to a regime where it slightly increases and passes through a maximum. And we do not, this is actually what we normally call the Fermi liquid regime, where we assume that it has to be constant. It is almost constant, and then it starts dropping. If you look at the 1 over tau, the other part that's measured, there's nothing there at 200 Kelvin, or very, very difficult to see. If you really stretch your imagination, you might see there's a bend roughly over there. Whereas the superconducting effect is very clear in this case. This is clearly at TC around 70 Kelvin, which you do not see in this part. So actually, depending on what you look at, you can pick up your superconducting effect, or you can pick up the pseudogap effect. And that actually tells you that these things are, that the pseudogap and superconductivity are doing different things. If both would have to do with forming pairs, preformed pairs, and then more pairs at TC, you would see the same signature, but we see different signatures, and more strong in the superconducting, for the superconducting one. One more minute? Half a minute. Okay, so another thing we did very recently, picked up again very recently, you'd say, is to look at this quantity. This is the loss function. The loss function you can get, for example, from ellipsometry by measuring the ratio of P polarized over S polarized light with its phase. You plug it into this formula, it gives you the energy loss function. Very easy to do. Even the formula is easy. Gives you this kind of things. This is the energy loss function, as one could also measure it with inelastic electron scattering spectroscopy. And for the same sample, this is the integrated loss function as a function of temperature. So the integration removes a lot of noise. It makes it a pretty nice and smooth curve. And what you see is it increases like T square, in fact. It's T square because the dotted line is a constant minus T square and actually falls everywhere below this blue curve. Right? And then it's no longer fits at a certain moment, it goes up a little bit extra. This is around TC, a little bit higher. And so you might say, okay, this has to do with the TC, but nowhere in this curve, really, you can see T star. And again, it illustrates the effect, the fact that whatever you have in T star in optics, if you just look at spectral weights and things, is not showing up at high energies. The TC, the superconducting effects, you see also at high energies, but T star you do not see at high energies. And again, that suggests that a T star is driven by entirely different physics, much more subtle physics, actually, than the superconductivity, which is already quite subtle as a correlation. That leads me to the conclusions. So the pseudogap shows up clearly in frequency dependence along the A-axis and the C-axis, more along C than along A, but you see it in both. An important part of the pseudogap spectral features have to do with the incoherent part of the optical response function, and actually that part gives you also consistency with TC, for whatever it's worth. Now, the temperature dependence gives you a crossover temperature. It shows up in the relaxation rate and in the C-axis conductivity. It's also seen in the effective mass, even more clearly as a maximum, and there are no discernible effects if you go to high frequency like 1 eV, yet around that region, you see the effects of the superconducting phase transition quite well, as we have known for a long time. That was all I had to say. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.